This past Tuesday, President Trump delivered a speech to the UN General Assembly, which contained words and ideas that the delegates never had placed before them. Instead of some sort of soft angel food cake, Trump served up some cold, hard facts. Of course, the leaders of those nations that the president targeted, along with the American liberals, news media expressed outrage over Trump's speech. For the people of the world who are being oppressed, President Trump's speech might actually become the foundation for an uprising in a variety of ways. With us now to give her analysis of President Trump's UN speech as a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, an award-winning journalist, author of the book What to Do About the UN, Claudia Rosette. Thanks for being here today, Claudia.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And for the website for Independent Women's Forum, where you can read Claudia's writings and others, IWF.org. When you look at speeches delivered at the United Nations, and keeping in mind that UN General Assembly is a place that allowed Arafat to show up armed when he gave his speech, and they've put Iran on human rights commissions. But has there been any other speech by any American president that matches what Trump accomplished this past week?
I haven't listened to every speech delivered since the founding of the UN by American presidents, so I couldn't tell you that for certain, but what I can tell you is it was a terrific speech. And certainly over the past decade, it was an extraordinary speech. I mean, for the first time in years, the American president stood up in front of the General Assembly and told really important truths about what's happening in the world and what really should matter to America.
He did an interesting mix, too, because he started off with, I want to just bring up the transcript here real quick. He starts off by establishing America's strength. Fortunately, the U.S. has done very well since Election Day, stock market all-time high. He just lists all the assets that we have as far as job creation and unemployment at the low end. So he put America, ironically, in first as far as the stature. He combined the reality of foreign affairs. He injected history into the speech. I mean, it wasn't a single point speech. It had its points of priority, though.
Yeah, what he was doing, I think, look, the basic thing he's got to do is tell the world that America, after retreating and basically giving a bargain sale on its interests, on its own interests for years under President Obama, is done with that. He had to say, "You don't mess with us, you will pay. You're our friend, you will benefit." It's, you know, we actually stand up for ourselves. One of the things I really liked was that he reminded all the eminences, there were 193 member states of the UN, more than half of them are not free.
Right.
Okay, and some are as bad as North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, China, Russia. He reminded them all that America actually lives by the values in the Charter, that we're a free society, which is not the case for a lot of the people living in, who were sitting in that hall. And he said, "I'll stand up for America." He reminded them of why they should respect that. And again, you'll read a lot of things in the media, confrontational speech, menacing speech, you know, said the New York Times and the Washington Post. There's a huge amount of posturing that goes on at the UN. I think, although I cannot read the minds of the various leaders of the countries around the world, that whatever they say in public, this causes them to think, to reflect that actually America doesn't want to be pushed around, which has been the case. You know, America has contributed so much to the world by virtue of what we are, this extraordinary experiment in democracy and free markets. And putting that out in front of people, even if the despots who go there don't like it at all, there are people who live under them who will think, who will say, "Well, wait a minute, we have potentially an ally in the American White House again." So he laid out something, I think, just extremely important, and he did it in direct terms. And instead of this sort of UN diplo fiction, diplo speak that we typically hear in the General Assembly. Then he went on to call out specific dictatorships in terms that were bullseye. He was exactly right. And North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, and a point about the horrible devastation left by socialism and communism, that was just superb. Even if it's not considered polite at the United Nations to say these things, they're true.
Well, as if Donald Trump would care about political correctness at probably the most incorrect location there is in our world at this point in time. And There were points, too, I don't know if it's intentionally or if it's just a result of the flow of the speech, where some of it, it sounded like he was talking to the people of these countries. Like this one part, to put it simply, we meet at a time of both immense promise and great peril. It's entirely up to us whether we lift the world to new heights or let it fall into a valley of disrepair. Now, if I'm a citizen of pick a country right now and I hear those words, I'm thinking, yeah, it's time for our leaders to own up to some of this now.
Yeah, for instance, if you're a citizen of Iran.
Exactly.
Possibly of Russia, possibly of China. Or, yeah, I think that's right. And that is, you know, it's a stage where officially the various heads, eminences, as they're called at the UN, our excellencies, are addressing the General Assembly. Actually, it's a world stage. And there's a tremendous amount of a lot of messages that are sent, many for domestic consumption by various leaders, rulers. But this, I think, was a message to the world. And again, speaking to the people who live under some of these systems, very important. What I'm hoping when he talks about North Korea and says the U.S. really is going to stand up to this rocket man. I like that term, actually. I think it was much better than calling Kim Jong-un Excellency or Supreme Leader.
Yes.
That we're really going to stand up to him. If there are people living, if there are people serving under Kim Jong-un in North Korea who have potentially the ability to overthrow the Kim regime, I believe they must be listening to that with great interest. In other words, it matters to appeal to sort of the layers down below the dictator and to be sending the message that if you make a move, we will be there, as opposed to we're so intent on cutting a deal with your ruler, with your tyrant, that you don't even think about it. He's the guy we do business with. So it was potentially very important. And menacing? I mean, the menace is because it's North Korea that's been testing the hydrogen bomb and sending missiles over Japan and threatening nuclear strikes on U.S. territory and our allies. It's Russia that seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. It's China that's building artificial islands and putting military bases on top of them in the South China Sea. So I wouldn't actually call it menacing. I would say Trump stood up for American interests in a very important way.
As well as freedom and liberty for those who either have it or those who are seeking to attain it in their countries. We're talking with Claudia Rosette, who is a senior foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. She's an award-winning journalist traveling the world, expert on the UN, as evidenced by her new book, What to Do About the UN. IWF.org is the website for Independent Women's Forum. And you're listening to Issues and Ideas. President also sought to, I guess, get ahead of or break any criticism of America that could come following his speech. One of the lines was, in America, we do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather let it shine as an example for everyone to watch, meaning that we're not here to create nations or impose our will on you. We think we got it right here. Why don't you come on in and join the party?
Yeah, well, what he's calling attention to, again, in very stark contrast to President Obama's approach, is that we actually are not a country of conquest. We're a country where our influence has spread because people like it. They emulate it. They sign on to it. People like, you know, in the main, once it's established, they like freedom. They like being able to trade as they like in markets. We're an experiment, but we're a very old experiment at this point. America is the world's oldest democracy. I guess Switzerland could contend for that. We have a constitution that is really a landmark in human history. And I think the thing that sets us apart in world affairs is we don't intrude and hold vast swaths of conquered territory. We saved Europe in World War II and helped them up to their feet and basically left. Okay, we kept bases in a number of places to protect them and ourselves against the Soviet Union. We still have military in Europe, in Japan. The thing that's been happening in the world that under President Obama that has become, has turned things so extremely dangerous, is America was pulling back from all these places where we have actually stood. It's a platitude, it's a cliche, but it's true. As a bulwark of freedom, America, that has been our role. And President Trump, I think there are a lot of things we still need to figure out about exactly what he means. I think he's figuring them out, and I can understand that in a scene of enormously complex threats that was bequeathed by years of President Obama's retreat, strategic patience, passivity, surrender of U.S. interests, the rotten Iran nuclear deal, the doing nothing about North Korea while it carried out one nuclear test after another. But basically, I don't want to make that too complicated. The bottom line is Trump was saying, we're a free country. That's what's made us mighty. We've been a beacon to the world for a long time. That's the role that we will continue to play. We invite you to be part of this. And for those who threaten it, he specifically pointed out that the big threat to the world today comes from a small number of rogue regimes that pay no attention to the international rules. And he said, if you do things like that, you will pay, thus the warnings to North Korea. Thus, I thought the brilliant summary of what the Iranian state really is, the Tehran regime, where he called it, he said it basically, it's the Iranian government, I'm quoting here, masks a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of a democracy. It has turned a wealthy country with a rich history and culture into an economically depleted rogue state whose chief exports are violence, bloodshed, and chaos. Now, the Iranian regime naturally did not like that and has asked for an apology. I sure hope they don't get it, because it was absolutely right. And to hear that said in so many words in front of the UN General Assembly was, I think, tremendously refreshing, and I think a very, very good thing for the world and for America.
In addition to how Trump specifically mentioned all of North Korea's at least most recent sins, the obvious with missiles and violations of sanctions, and also included the American college student Otto Warmbier, who they tortured, yeah. And he passed away. He mentioned the story. I would hazard to guess almost no one knew about the 13-year-old Japanese girl who was kidnapped to use
as a... Megumi Yokota. Yes, that was a horrible, heartbreaking case, and that is North Korea, classic North Korea. This was years ago, but they carried on with this for years, denied anything for effect. People didn't know. She was a young Japanese girl on her way home, I believe, from badminton practice, and vanished on the coast, western coast of Japan, just vanished. And for years, her desperate, heartbroken family tried to find out what had happened. And what they finally learned, incredible as it sounded, but it was true, is that she had been kidnapped by North Korea. And just as President Trump said, taken to North Korea, effectively enslaved to teach their spies how to behave like Japanese. And she finally died there. It was horrible. And they still have people who were kidnapped that way. They still hold them. It's very hard to know just what to believe because they lie. One point, under duress from the Japanese, they admitted that they had kidnapped people. Then they began walking it back, as North Korea does. But for the Japanese, who were conveniently close to North Korea, where they suffered a whole series of these kidnappings, it's a huge issue. It's because it's a horrible thing. This is not a gang. This is not some criminal gang with no locus or no official status. This is the sovereign state of North Korea, which, as part of its state policy, was kidnapping people going about their daily lives in other countries. And they did this not just in Japan, but in many countries around the world, and bringing them back as slaves to teach North Korean spies. It's horrible. Megumi Yokota, that's the name. If you go look up that up online, you can read this heartbreaking story. Otto Warmbier, the American student who went to North Korea on a tour and took a poster off a wall. And for that, they put him in this horrible, devastating, terrifying show trial and then abused him in some way that destroyed his brain and kept him for more, well over a year, apparently, in that state, before finally they allowed his America to bring him home so he could die with his family. That is North Korea, and these are what that's what they do to foreigners. What they do to their own people is just monstrous. What this regime has done to keep itself in power, the UN, which tends to go light on dictatorships, actually stepped up and did a very long report in 3 years ago on North Korea's human rights abuses. And they concluded that for the gravity and severity of the violations there, there is no parallel in the modern world. That this is out of George Orwell and the totalitarian state at its worst. So, and for Trump to specify, to name specifically some of these details, the Otto Warmbier case, the kidnapping of Japanese teenager Megumi Yokota, to point out what really is going on, that's extremely important. I mean, bravo, that made it a great speech.
And that's why I believe at least it'll go down as a historic speech, because I'm anticipating that it's a speech that will institute change, maybe not to the immediate levels that we hope for, but a catalyst for change nevertheless. She is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, award-winning journalist. She's traveled the world and special focus on the United Nations, their work or lack thereof in some cases. Author of the book, What to Do About the UN. You can read Claudia's writings at IWF.org. Claudia Rosette, thanks so much for your insight and for being here today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.